Hello and welcome to this episode of the Offspring Magazine podcast. I'm Julie and I will be hosting this episode. I'm very excited to introduce this fourth and last part of my black hole series. To send you off on your way through space and time, I recorded a conversation with Nobel laureate Professor Reinhard Genzel. Professor Genzel has spent most of his career proving the existence of a supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way. For his work, he has received numerous prizes, most recently and most importantly, the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2020, together with Andrea Goetz and Roger Penrose. He tells a fascinating story of how, in a decades-long effort, he, together with his colleagues, managed to measure the orbits of stars around the galactic center so precisely that it leaves no doubt that they must be orbiting around a supermassive black hole. Stick around and enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to this new episode of the Offspring Magazine podcast. I am Julie and I will be hosting this episode. I am today here at the Max Planck Institute for Extraterrestrial Physics with Professor Reinhard Genzel. Welcome and thank you so much for joining this episode.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so let's get started. You started studying the galactic center I think after your PhD, when you went to the US for a postdoc, am I correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, basically, I started my research in astronomy at another Max Planck Institute for radio astronomy, which at that time just got started. Astronomy was not all that that popular in Germany. See, it was mostly physics, of course. My father was a physicist. Solid-state physicist, and he was also a Max Planck director, so I actually knew from him that there was this opportunity of going to this new institute, and then from there on, it was pretty automatic to go to the U.S. As a big next step. Actually, at that time, I should say, I was quite happy to leave Germany, and mm-hmm. perhaps if it would have turned out differently, I would have stayed in the U.S., okay. When I came to the U.S. at that time, I did continue to do radio astronomy, and in particular a technique which is called very long baseline interferometry, which mm-hmm. basically allows you to take radio telescopes across, nowadays, the entire globe, basically record the signals, and then construct afterwards, after the fact, an image out of this, which has, you know, absolutely fantastic resolution. So this is very important for the later parts of my work on the galactic center. After 2 years, I however then had the opportunity to join the group of a very famous physicist in California, Charles Townes. Townes is sort of one of the great heroes of experimental yeah. physics. When he was young, after the war, he was interested in molecules and how molecules would work, and for that he needed a light source, but not in the optical, but in the, you know, short wavelength radio domain, millimeter and submillimeter, as we call it, far infrared, and there was no such a bright source, yeah. and so this is how he came to develop what we now know as the laser and the maser, and that got him the Nobel Prize. Mm-hmm. And so I got that chance. I knew about him from my father, but also from the work they were doing. I was fascinated by the style of their research in Berkeley. Mm-hmm. So getting that opportunity was just absolutely fantastic. And there, indeed, Townes was already at work with his students and postdocs to look for this black hole in the galactic center. So let me perhaps sort of as a background, of course, black holes is, if you look at it from today's perspective, a very fundamental and mm-hmm. fascinating subject in many ways.
Yeah.
Physics as well as astronomy.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the reason why towns actually got into this, and then I followed, was basically black holes were predicted, of course, by Einstein's general relativity, and several solutions were known mathematically for the field equations, which then have this property that if a mass is concentrated enough, that gravity is strong enough, then even light cannot escape anymore. So that's sort of the very simple way of understanding what a black hole is, so to speak. This has, however, a second conclusion behind it, which is light cannot escape, but if you and I would go on a rocket and fly into a black hole, and we would then disappear, so to speak, behind what's known as the event horizon, which is the region where light cannot escape anymore, then we cannot stop. Okay, we cannot stop. We would just inevitably fly to the center, and there, basically, in terms of what general relativity predicts, crash in the very center in a infinite density point, which is the singularity. So that's a prediction which we would like to test, because most of us in physics believe this cannot be true. There must be a point in size where this prediction by general relativity, which is a classical theory, has to be amended to a quantum theory, which is not, does not exist quite yet. But anyhow, so this is the theory, and but the question is whether nature has deemed it necessary and useful to realize these objects. So that really didn't happen. I mean, general relativity had these solutions, and the mathematicians were working on that, but really there was no other relation to the real universe.
So when did this change?
Well, that happened in the 1960s. Two things happened. Number one is the new field of X-ray astronomy, studying X-rays. Were looking at the skies and were finding binary objects, so two stars, if you like, where one star was visible in the optical, but the second one not, but then was visible in X-rays and highly variable and so forth. And how could that be? Well, the understanding was, okay, if a star, a massive star, has used up most or all of its hydrogen to make fusion and energy, then gravity takes over. And so then it would collapse.
Yeah.
And in this collapsing state, however, processes happen which make part of the object explode as a supernova, as we say. And then ashes remain, so to speak, which collapse to a further small region, and that can become a black hole. It can also become a neutron star, but it can become a black hole. So that's the first of the discoveries in the 60s. So the second one was a phenomenon we call quasars, where radio astronomers, also looking at the skies for the first time in detail, discovered very distant objects billions of light years away, which at that time was a sensation. I mean, the billions of light years means the light has taken almost a significant fraction of the age of the universe to get to us, and so that was absolutely not seen before. And so because these objects are so far away, it means they are enormously luminous, yet at the same time they're very compact, that you can see from the variability of these sources. So the theorists then went ahead and started, you know, thinking about how could you generate, you know, 1,000 times as much luminosity as the entire Milky Way with all of that in a region of only, say, a light year across or something like this. And so the paradoxical explanation which came out of this is black holes.
Okay.
Yeah. So now you would say, wait, how can that be now? And the answer is the idea of a black hole and this gravity, which is so strong that light cannot escape, is only true within a finite radius, this event horizon. So the event horizon, for if the Earth would be a black hole, that event horizon would be 1 centimeter in size.
Mm-hmm.
So compress the entire Earth
yeah.
to 1 centimeter, then would be a black hole. In the case of the Sun, that number is 3 kilometers.
Yeah.
And if you go up with mass, well, then the radius is proportional to the mass.
Yeah.
And so the region outside this event horizon, however, you can see. Although, because the gravity is so strong also outside, that means that the light which is emitted arrives at our place redshifted. So mm-hmm. it can be very, very much redshifted. And that's basically the idea. You have gas falling in or stars falling in to an object you would call a black hole. And on the way in, you gain energy because of the gravity, and so that you can convert into radiation. And then, of course, at the end of this journey, the gas would disappear behind the event horizon. But as long as it's not outside of the event horizon, it can radiate. So that was the idea. But, you know, ideas or proposals or theories in physics and in sciences, of course, is always a little of an interesting possibility in order to prove it. That's really how we...
So you need to find a way to prove that there's an object there that you would actually call a black hole.
And the idea is basically use gravity again.
Yeah.
So think of the solar system. So we have the sun dominating the mass in the solar system. And then you have the planets. And the planets move on orbits, as we know, from Kepler, you know, quasi-circles or ellipses around the sun. And if you measure the orbital velocities as a function of distance for the different planets, then you go further out, then the velocities go down.
Mm-hmm.
In a very characteristic way, Kepler's laws.
Yeah.
Okay, so the further you're out, the slower the velocity. And so you turn that around in your mind. Suppose you switch off the sun, the light of the sun, that is, but keep the mass.
Yeah.
So in that system, the planets would more or less move around the same orbits they are in our system, but you can't see the sun. So how do you know that there's a sun? Well, you would go ahead and measure the motions of the planets, mm-hmm. and you would have to conclude there's an object in the center which dominates the mass, and it has one solar mass. So that's the same, that's the idea how you would test that. But the problem is for these quasars, which I mentioned, they are so far away
mm-hmm.
that at least at that time it was not practical to make a measurement of sort of the environment of the central region and seeing things move. And so there was a very important publication in 1971 by two British theorists who said, well, these quasars obviously are very rare objects, okay? And that is because they have such high rates of accretion,
mm-hmm.
and maybe that occurs only rarely. That's what we also actually know now.
Yeah.
So perhaps then, if these are rare because they're distant, they're rare, there are others which also have black holes, but they don't have such high accretion.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, we know that is the case. We know nowadays that essentially every galaxy, every Milky Way, has a central black hole, and the relationship between the black hole in the center and that of the galaxy is a very, linear almost one, in that the bigger the galaxy, the bigger the black hole.
Yeah.
Okay, so if that is the case, well, maybe also nearby galaxies have black holes. And if it's a nearby galaxy, the nearest is our own.
Yeah.
So that's where the galactic center comes in. So when Towns and then I and so forth started looking at the galactic center, we don't do this necessarily to prove something about the Milky Way, but we're using the Milky Way center as the nearest laboratory, if mm-hmm. you like, to test the idea as such.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So before that, was the galactic center of major interest to astronomers, or were you the first ones?
No, okay, well, sure, of course. But it's not easy, actually, turns out. Why? Well, this object is 27,000 light years away. So we are in the outskirts of the Milky Way,
Yes.
in the outer parts. So when we look towards the center, what do we see in the optical? Nothing. Okay, that's the problem. Why don't we see anything? Well, because the Milky Way is a sort of a disk galaxy, a spiral galaxy, as we say, right? And so there's are the stars, 1,000 billion stars. And between the stars, however, there is a very, a certain amount of material, small amount of material, in form of gas and dust. And the dust absorbs visible light and ultraviolet light. So turns out there is enough dust in this interstellar material between us and the galactic center that none of the light which gets emitted in the galactic center reaches us. So you have to then go to wavelengths where the waves can pass through the dust, and that's longer wavelength. So radio waves would do that, but radio waves are not a very good way to look at stars, which is or gas, which is what we wanted to do. So next best thing is the so-called near infrared, mid infrared, where you can observe from the ground and you can look into the galactic center. And that's what Townes did. And Townes had the experimental capabilities from his laboratory work to do what we call spectroscopy. So you basically you look at molecular transitions and atomic transitions of ionized and cold gas in the galactic center, and then you can use this spectroscopy to see the Doppler motions. Towards us and away from us, so the spectral lines are shifted depending on the degree of motion, and so that is one way, at least along the line of sight, to measure the velocities, and so then you can do this Kepler experiment if you like, and Townes had started that in the mid 70s, so before I actually joined, but then our apparatus was getting better all the time, and we get ever more information, so that by mid 80s we were ready to tell everyone, look, these motions are very large, unusually large for if there would only be stars and everything else. So we postulated that there was a few million solar masses in form of a black hole somewhere in the center. Better we couldn't tell, and honestly, nobody believed us at the time. That is the fate of new things.
Why didn't they believe you?
Well, the answer is not twofold. One is the technique that we're using uses gas, and gas is very thinly distributed material, and that you can affect and push around with forces other than gravity. Yeah? So, for instance, magnetic fields, if they are there, especially the ionized gas, sees the magnetic fields and is basically, sticking to the field lines. And so that would, change the motion compared to only gravity. And the other one is that the motions we were seeing, these gas cloud motions, in terms of a few million solar mass black hole, were way out there in terms of distance. So, about 1 million times the event horizon. So most people said, okay, well, it's interesting that you see these large gas motions, but how do you know this has to be a black hole?
It's so far away
Yeah, it's so
and
far away, and you're not sure.
confusing.
So that this was the beginning of a journey, which turns out lasted then another 35 years, because we had to always go a next step in resolution, get better resolution, use new techniques, use bigger telescopes. But then you run into the problems with the atmosphere. The atmosphere distorts the images, and of course you could say, why don't you go in space? Well, the biggest telescope at that time was the Hubble Space Telescope, and that's not a very big telescope. And so we knew, okay, we want to measure in the near infrared. We want to measure not gas but stars, because stars are a better way of of seeing gravity motions, and we want to have much higher resolution, angular resolution. So we want to have big telescopes. Well, the big telescopes at that time were 4 meter class telescopes, but then a few years later came 10 meter class telescopes.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's sort of the regime. And nowadays what we do is we do the same what the radio astronomers when I was young.
Yeah.
Did we use interferometry? That is, we take the 4 8-meter telescopes of the so-called VLT, the Very Large Telescopes of the European Southern Observatory in Chile, best site in the world, and we connect, so to speak, through light paths, the light from the different telescopes, and thereby we then have the resolution of a 100-meter telescope through this, and so. But this takes time.
Yeah.
Takes time and effort, and you're always improving the technology, and so that is why it took in my case a long long time until we had really the case so well presented, and a second group also in California then did the same, Andrea, I guess, that people, first of all, they could see what we got, we and they.
Yeah.
That was a very good test. If you get different answers, well, then maybe what one group concludes is not the right one. No, we got a similar answer. And then ever better in terms of resolution.
Yeah.
So that's how this all happened.
Okay. So let's maybe go back into a bit more detail. So you mentioned the first measurements, and you were observing gas clouds via this spectroscopy and Doppler shifts of the gas clouds. And people weren't believing you because basically there were other reasons why these gas clouds could be moving the way they move. And also you were too far away. So then the next step was like, okay, we have to move closer to convince people. And we moved to other objects than gas clouds because people won't believe us if it's gas.
That's
so
right.
That's why you then said, okay, then we have to find stars.
Stars, yes.
To do this. Okay. But so did you already, before the times of interferometry and the very large telescopes, did you try? Was it possible to find stars already?
Oh, yeah. No, I think the first, I should say, if you go through this in time, the first difficulty at the time was, remember, we are not in the optical, we are in the so-called near-infrared. You have to have sensors, detectors.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to do this efficiently, you want to actually, now in terms of the stars, what you're looking for is the motion. Easiest way to do this is to look at the motion on the sky.
Mm-hmm.
We call that proper motion, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you're not looking at, you can, but we were not only looking for the radial motion in spectroscopy, but then actually we were making images and looked how the stars were changing their position from year to year, basically. So the first real hurdle was we needed an imaging detector.
Mm-hmm.
So in an optical, that was known, and at that time, in fact, the CCD came in. But in the infrared, no, there was no device. And that was a bit of a struggle initially, and is a struggle up to now, really. What helped us, I have to say, was the fact that the military in the U.S., needed the same technology to look at Russian rockets.
Okay.
Yeah. And so they, in fact, had the money to make developments of semiconductor devices, which would allow you to create images. And over time, this then filtered through to the to the civilian sector, and later on also, actually, nowadays we build our own detectors, so it's not anymore that we depend on anyone. But that was really the big step, and in particular here in Germany, because at that time I had then moved from California to Germany, and to get a detector which is classified out of the U.S. into Germany, and that's not so easy. But anyhow, that was sort of the beginning issue. The next issue, we only had a 3.5-meter telescope available at that time on a good site in Chile, but only 3.5. So that's a pretty good resolution, but of course it would have been nice to have better resolution. So the progression was go ahead and start. Then come the issue of the Earth atmosphere. So if you recall, if you're in a very hot on a hot street, then the air is flimmering, right? And it's this effect which basically distorts the waves, and you cannot get to what we call the diffraction limit.
What is that?
Diffraction limit is a physical limitation which is given by the ratio of the diameter of the telescope and the wavelength. So the bigger that ratio, the higher the angular resolution. But as soon as you have the Earth atmosphere interfering, so to speak, then you can't get to that limit. So we had to learn how to fool the Earth atmosphere. Initially, we did that by making very rapid images so that the Earth atmosphere doesn't have time to distort the images. So you record all these short exposures, and then afterwards in the computer you move the images around. Not very efficient way of doing it, but that was how we started. And then the next big step was what we call adaptive optics. So you actually measure the distortions directly in the instrument, because you can take the light from a nearby star, and basically the star would be you know it's a point source basically, but when you record it you can see the distortions, and then you have what we call a deformable mirror in the train in the path to the detector, and you basically use that deformable mirror and a very fast computer to unbend what the Earth atmosphere has done.
So it's like a life correction
It's a
of.
life correction, and that is what all big telescopes do nowadays. In fact, there's another step, which is if you don't have a very bright star near the object you're looking at, then nowadays we make our own star. So we actually send a laser up into the upper atmosphere and generate, so to speak, a bright spot very close to the source. So, all these techniques had to be, brought in and then develop them to a degree which then could be used. And so in this process then we saw the first motions of these stars. As I said, they gave us the same result, by the way, as the gas clouds. But again, we were not so close to the center that this argument could it not be something else other than a black hole still was valid. And so the next step, well, there you need still bigger telescopes. That was then the transition to 8 and 10 meter class telescopes, which we have. But that still is not enough. It's only a factor of a few in terms of resolution. Yet I told you initially we were 1 million times away from the event horizon. So now we are maybe 100,000 times away from the event horizon. That's still not enough to convince everyone very clearly. People were impressed, so what do you do? Well, you have to be lucky. I mean, in this case, this is the limitation of doing physics experiments in the universe. You can't change the experiment, so to speak. You have to count on nature. And nature was very, very generous. They gave us stars. Nature gave us stars in the galactic center, which come as close as about 1,000 times the event horizon. And that was not expected. In fact, I mean, it would have been very clear to everyone if you would have told people, okay, we want to make that measurement. They would have said, no, it can't possibly be. But we went ahead, and we were lucky. Nature gave us stars. And the trick there is these stars are on extremely elliptical orbits. So, they are away most of the time, but then sometimes they come very close. And one of these stars, both Andrea and we then saw go through this very closest approach in 2002, a highly elliptical orbit, moving then at, 2.5% the speed of light. So that's about several hundred to 1,000 times the velocity of the Earth around the Sun. And then, in fact, the evidence was so good already then, because you could see this very fast motion, and now you're 1,000 times away. Then the probability that there are other options was getting dwindling
Okay.
to not zero, but to
Yeah.
very unlikely. And so by 2002, I would say most of the astronomy community was accepting, that's
Okay.
probably the best evidence we now have for these
Okay.
black holes to exist. But there are still a number of buts here. Number one is still 1,000 times away. And next one is basically you have to use general relativity to interpret the results, including also excluding alternative options. And so how do you know that general relativity actually holds in this regime? General relativity has been tested, numerous times, but in what we could call low curvature of space-time. So in
Right.
the laboratory on Earth or
Yeah.
in the solar system, this is a totally different regime there around a black hole. And so by 2000, 3 or 4, it was clear if we wanted to do better, then we had to observe this star and not only the motion, but actually the entire orbit and see it when it comes around the next time. We knew that it would happen 16 years later in 2018, and then have equipment which could see the effects of general relativity. And that was sort of a big challenge. And that then involved interferometry,
Okay.
so to bring together the four 8 meter telescopes in on Paranal and being ready on time, and et cetera. It's
Okay.
a very challenging development,
Yeah.
and but we were ready. And so by 2018, and now, I mean, tonight we're observing, okay,
Yeah.
with this and the amount of what we've learned in the last few years, also Andrea, but I mean, the interferometry is really unique now. Is fantastic. So we can actually see the in detail effects of general relativity. Indeed, they are just what general relativity predicts. We can say something about what other than a black hole there might be. I mean, there could be two black holes. There could be a big black hole and many, many other smaller black holes. And it appears that this is pretty lonely big black hole, okay?
Okay.
And the next thing is we can not only see these stars at 1,000 times the event horizon, we see also the environment of the event horizon glowing in infrared light, so once every day. And it turns out this is probably when there is a lot of acceleration of hot material, hot gases, which start then to produce a so-called synchrotron radiation and produce sort of a hot spot for a little while, about a few hours. And that moves. And we
Okay.
can see this motion on just a few times event horizon size. And that takes, say, 50 minutes or so to go around and moves at about a third speed of light. Okay, so that's pretty impressive.
That is impressive,
That's
yes.
pretty impressive. And at the same time, also the radio astronomers now have
Yeah.
been looking at this pretty much the same region. And they're using the fact that general relativity, of course, predicts that light is affected
Yeah.
by gravity. I mean, the fact that there's a black hole is
Yeah.
exactly that. But you can shine, so to speak, light from the backside at us. And then, obviously, if it were not general relativity but normal physics, you would certainly expect the event horizon to be black,
Yeah.
okay? Because everything would fall into the black hole. But in general relativity, actually, prediction is that the region where photons fall in is bigger than the event horizon due to the bending of light. And so that has now been measured,
Yeah.
and it's exactly how you would expect it for the mass which we've
Yeah.
measured. So I would say by excluding ever more the possibilities, we are now in the regime where we can say, yeah, that looks like a black hole, is a black hole. However, one has to be careful. I mean, physics never ends,
Yes,
I
yeah.
told you at the very beginning that there are things which general relativity predicts, which most of the physics community would say we don't think that this is the ultimate answer. The central singularity is one of them.
Yeah.
The other one is If you take a black hole and you grow its mass, say by throwing rocks in, okay? And suppose you have a second black hole of the same mass, but that one you've grown by throwing refrigerators in. Then general relativity would say, there's no difference because you only need three quantities, or rather, let's say two, to describe a black hole: its mass and then how fast it spins. Nothing else is needed. No other information is needed nor available. Okay, it's all hidden in the event horizon, and you can't get there. So, if from the point of view of general relativity, these objects are extremely simple, and yet at the same time, from a point of view of us, we cannot tell the rock black hole from the refrigerator black hole. And there, very general considerations in quantum theory say that can't be, because they are a conservation of quantum numbers, which we know happen in the quantum world, which would have to apply to a black hole as well if we had a proper theory of quantum gravity, which we don't, as I said. But these very general considerations then tell us there must be a difference between a rock black hole and a refrigerator black hole, so to speak. And so these questions will continue. And there are some people who say that black holes, in terms of physics, are sort of the atoms of the 21st century in terms of what we still don't know about them. Okay, so we now, with some certainty, know they exist. Also, I mentioned in the very beginning the so-called stellar black holes, which the X-ray community saw. That we can look at with great detail now with gravitational waves, which can be seen when two stellar black holes orbit each other and then lose energy because they radiate gravitational waves. In the end, they spiral inwards and then they merge towards a single black hole. So that has been seen. But many of the other properties we have not yet tested. And so that will keep, even after I'm looking at the daisies from below, I'm sure that will keep physicists busy. Now, there is another final aspect to all of this, which is the astronomy universe part. You know, what are they good for, these black holes? Do they have any role or what? Or they're just sort of sitting there as schmarotzers in the centers? And the answer, oh yeah, they have a very important role to play in the evolution of their host galaxy. So they both, we now know, formed very early in the universe, and then they grew together. And in the end, it can be that the central black hole, if it accretes a lot, starts actually spewing out enough energy and winds and all of that into the galaxy to, so to speak, kill the galaxy. Okay, by removing interstellar material, and the interstellar material is the food for forming new stars, so it can eject this interstellar material. All of a sudden, a galaxy makes a transition from sort of a galaxy like our own spiral galaxy with lots of gas and star formation into what we call an elliptical galaxy, which is basically dead. I mean, there's still stars there, old remnant stars, but not much new star formation. So we now know that this is a sort of this symbiosis between the black holes and the galaxies which they're in is a very important part of the evolution of the universe.
I mean, that's really interesting. I mean, and what you were saying, that there's so much that we might not yet know about the black holes and the atoms of the 21st century. It makes sense if you think about the fact that, well, we only saw them for the first time, as you said, in X-rays in the 70s, 60s. It's not that old. I mean, there are other parts in physics where people have been looking or like searching for things or discovering things for maybe even centuries when you look at astronomy. And we've only been doing this for a few decades, so it makes you excited for what else we can learn, I guess. I wanted to ask you more about Because you mentioned that you had these 16 years time between 2002, where you had these images that were, you were still doing with adaptive optics at that time, where you, where the point, that was the point where people were actually started believing kind of that is really a black hole there. And then you had these 16 years of getting interferometry working to actually capture the general relativistic effects. So how, like, what had to go into that, or like, how is infrared interferometry working? Is it different from radio interferometry? How, what technology did you develop?
So what is the principle of this interferometry? Basically, what you do in any telescope, right, is you have waves coming in, light waves or radio waves, doesn't make any difference. And the telescope is such that you basically have a shape of this telescope, parabolic shape, which then focuses the light to a point. And there you have a detector and you make an image. That's the picture of a telescope. Now, you can replace in thought this continuous structure here by only a few points. And again, do the same. You bring the light together and focus it. You can again focus it and get an image. It's not as good an image as you know a full telescope would be. So interferometry to first order, it's just doing the same. You do interference of light in a common focus, and then you basically in this process then form an image. You can, however, go one step further. You can take these points which I had, say four, and you record actually here and here and here. Not the intensity, what you're seeing here, but the electromagnetic field strength and the so-called phase. And if you have that, so to speak, recorded in your detector, then you can go away and then make this interference, which we did so far, directly in the path afterwards, one by one. So this is the very long baseline idea. You don't have to do the detection, as we say, right away. You can also do it later on, as long as you can store the information. But in optical wavelength or infrared wavelengths, you have real additional difficulties. First, you're much, much shorter wavelength. Okay? So the accuracy of determining phases and making this interference is, you know, about a million times more difficult than in the classical radio regime. The next the changes in atmospheric conditions is much faster also, because now you're at shorter wavelength and so everything is much faster. So in the radio regime you have minutes or even hours before things change due to the atmosphere. In the optical near infrared it takes a millisecond. So when you do any experiment, you have to be, you know, you have to be very, very fast. And fast means, of course, the detectors have to be very fast. Then they shouldn't be noisy, and so forth. So there are a number of challenges. The next one is this interference we were using here has to, of course, relate to an accuracy. This thing really has to be a parabolic. Okay, with a very great accuracy, so that all the rays come together exactly as they should. So, if you now think of your four telescopes which you're using instead of this, then you have to basically add these rays from the different the waves from these different points very accurately. And again, that's a small fraction of the wavelength. In the radio, that's not so difficult, but in the optical. So you see, I mean, it basically, in principle, it's the same thing, but then in practice, you know, it's yeah. If you think about all the factors involved, it's a very large factor more difficult in the optical regime. But then technology has moved on. I mean, optical interferometry was, in fact, tried 100 years ago by Michelson, a very famous physicist, And so what he did was he would take an optical telescope and put little periscopes on top and take exactly like I said here and bring the light together from these outrigger periscopes in the big telescope. And with that, he could actually resolve stars, but only very, very bright stars. Okay, and so it took, you can say it took 100 years, but of that 100 years, really, the last, say, 20 years of technology to do exactly that, but now to a degree where it's extremely accurate, and also the sensitivity is good enough that we can do this in the galactic center. And this machine which we built for the VLT called Gravity is really world unique at this point. I'm sure there will be others in the future, but it's really a big step. And when we started it, most people would say you can't do that. I mean, it's just not possible. But my co-worker and colleague Frank Eisenhower, who led that experiment, is really a genius. And so we had a very, very good team, and so we actually managed to put it together, and as I said, on time, so that the star is coming.
Yeah, that's the thing. Nature doesn't wait. And like, if you had would have missed that, you would have had to wait another 16 years. So that's really an incredible achievement that you managed to do that. Yeah, very impressive.
Well, I should say, of course, perhaps we can put it in perspective. Many of the things we did, first of all, of course, we owe to the fact that we have a fantastic team of young people. And that's, you can't do that by yourself. It's very clear. So it's not my Nobel Prize, it's a prize for the entire team. And the second thing, of course,
How
is
big is the team? Sorry to ask.
well, it's a European team. This interferometer team is about 50 people now.
Okay,
Yeah,
yeah.
here in at our institutes, maybe 20, 15, 20 people.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's getting there. I mean, these are not cheap experiments
Yeah.
anymore, which is of course a bit of a concern if you want to still do better in the future. Yeah, and the other thing is the Max Planck Society. I mean, I think, as I said, I enjoyed extremely the possibilities and the excitement in the US. But although I was doing very well there in the mid 80s and would have stayed in Berkeley, when I got the offer from Max Planck, I knew that this would be the right thing to do. Although the blue skies in California and the rest of it are very attractive, I knew that this would be why. It's because in the US, and in fact in the German university system, let's be clear about it, anything you would like to do, of course, you have to write a proposal. That's okay. I mean, if you're convincing, yeah. But the so-called peer reviewers who look at the proposal and judge whether you should be getting money or not, of course, are people who are critical and conservative. Conservative means, let's look at our star again. If I would have written, and then we want to observe stars, which come as close as the 1,000 Schwarzschild radii, conventional wisdom at that time, it would have said no, they don't exist. And in fact, I can. This is not just an assumption I'm making. Andrea Ghez initially crashed in the U.S. exactly because of that reason. Her first proposal to do what we already were doing. We were a little ahead, but we didn't have yet first results. Andrea pr proposed a funding proposal to do exactly that, and the reviewer said, no, they can't do that. Then later on, she got funding to do it anyhow, and we had, of course, already gotten the results. But that's where Max Planck is unique, that you, so to speak, as a director here or group leader, you get the opportunity of doing very high risk projects mm-hmm. over a pretty long period of time yeah. also. As long as you can show that you're making progress. I mean, it's not that we are trusted for everything, but yeah. There is control in the system, but still, it's possible to do risky things, mm-hmm. and that then can pay off.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it always pays off, but it can pay
yeah,
off.
Yeah, that's the thing with the high risk projects. Yeah, and some of them might not pay off, but if they do, it's a Nobel Prize. the measurement that you have done of the mass of the black hole at the center, it is an extremely precise measurement, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it the most precise measurement that we have of any black hole, or?
Oh yeah, by far.
Yeah.
I mean, the you know, when you talk about precision, you have to be very careful. So there's one thing which we call the statistical precision. And there's a second you would have to call the accuracy of the measurement, including all other possible sources of uncertainty, including systematics.
Mm-hmm.
So in measurement, in experimental ethics, you have to always distinguish between the two. So in terms of statistical, how well can we, so to speak, measure, that's now better than 0.1%. So it's about 8 by 10 minus 4. That's by far the most. But if she asked, well, you know, have you really understood all the sources of systematics, then the systematic uncertainty is, I would say, 3-4 times worse. So, but that still is, I don't know, 0.3% or something like mm-hmm. this.
Yeah.
So for astronomy standards, that's pretty damn good. I mean, there's, in astronomy, it used to be that the physics community, remember my father was a physicist, they would all say, ah, yeah, the astronomers, my God, I mean, an order of magnitude is what they do. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not the case anymore in some regimes. I mean, the most well-known is, of course, cosmology and the expansion of the universe yeah. and so forth. That's where precision measurements are possible by, you know, basically using many, 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 many objects in order to mm-hmm. get the statistical accuracy. And the Galactic Center is now a second case where you can really measure things extremely well. And, you know, you're better that you can do this, then in the end you can drive up the detail you will get in terms of the physics behind it.
Yeah, awesome. And another question I thought of, you, because we're always talking about the stars and that people weren't even expecting them to be there. But why exactly? Why weren't they thinking that they could
be there? Very good question. Okay, the answer is the following. I mean, suppose you put a black hole into a galactic nucleus. Because it's like the sun and the planets, what you get is an energy interaction through gravity and energy exchanges in the system. And in this energy exchange, basically, you create objects which lose energy, and therefore they move inward.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have, you know, stars of different masses and also stellar black holes, then you would expect the most massive of the stars to move the most efficiently inward.
Mm-hmm.
So after a while, you would expect there's the black hole, then the most massive systems, are stellar black holes. So there is a sort of a concentration of stellar black holes. But stellar black holes are rare, really. I mean, there are very, very few stellar black holes. Then neutron stars should also be there because they are, you know, moderately massive, actually. More massive stars might also move inward, but it takes too long relative to their lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, otherwise you would expect them to, you know, be the closest. And nature has found a way to trick these timescales. If you have a situation of a binary object and the big black hole, where the binary, by chance, is initially on an almost parabolic orbit. So if you, so to speak, go out very distant from the black hole, and you have a process, what we call scattering, which brings the binary on essentially randomly on an orbit which is almost directly pointed at the center. Then it flies inward, and that could now be two fairly massive and young stars. Mm-hmm. And the reason they move inward is just directly, aimed at the galactic center. And now happens, as you go inward, the velocity of the binary is getting bigger and bigger, of course, right? And at some point, the velocity of the binary is far in excess of the binding energy of these two stars,
okay,
if they were out there.
Okay.
So then you get a three-body interaction between the big black hole and this binary, where a little bit of energy is transferred from that binary to that one. Then this turns out that binary, that member of the binary, is not bound anymore. Mm-hmm. And this one is strongly bound. So it disrupts the binary instantaneously in here. This one is get shot out, and that one gets stuck. Now very far in.
Ah, okay.
So that's a process which you wouldn't necessarily think about,
no.
But that's likely the process which generates these very strongly bound, highly elliptical orbit stars we're looking at. They're young, they're massive, and in addition, they were probably part of a binary, and the other binary, of course, I said, is shot out. Now, how fast? Well, the velocity is thousands of kilometers per second, and so then this pipe, what one calls a hypervelocity star, is moving out of the galactic center, out of the Milky Way, and is leaving the galaxy. And these stars are seen.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, one has seen maybe 50 such stars, and for a few, you can actually measure well enough their orbits that you can say they come from the galactic center, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. Fascinating.
So the only other way to do this is you form stars. I mean, the stars we are looking at are fairly bright, very massive, say 5 to 15 solar masses, sometimes even more massive, and young. And this trick of beating the sort of speed at which they can sink in otherwise through energy exchange is sort of the first way to do this. Another way of doing this is you bring in gas.
Mm-hmm.
You bring in gas, and then you let the gas fall into the galactic center, and then at some point it will shock, get very high temperature, and then cool again, and then you might form stars. Locally.
Yeah.
And that actually is a process which happens in the galactic center,
mm-hmm.
but not in this innermost region.
Okay.
Because there, the density of the gas, in order to be self-gravitating and overcoming the, mm-hmm. the tidal forces from the black holes, is just too much.
Mm-hmm.
But a little further out there, in fact, are a few million years ago, about 200 stars formed. And we see these stars. Okay, they're in sort of a disc-like configuration.
Yeah. Are these stars, when they move at this very fast velocity close to the black hole, are they deformed in any way?
Very good question. You know the details. Yep, and that's one way of destroying stars, is tidal disruption.
Uh-huh.
So if a star goes by chance, say, close enough that the force from the black hole to the front part of the star and the back side of the star is sufficiently different that it cannot be held together by internal gravity of the star, then you can imagine the thing, specketifies, and then part of the star, about half of the mass of the star, falls in, and the other half of the star ejected back out. In fact, we've seen such an object, although it was probably not a star, but a perhaps the outer parts of a star, so the ionized gas around the star, or only a dense gas cloud. We don't know the details, but what we've seen is indeed one such object to come into the galactic center pretty much the same distance, but then start to spaghettify. And the expectation, in fact, was that it's disrupted and then falls in. But it didn't do that, actually. But it's coming back out, and it's beginning to recollect itself, so to speak. Yeah.
Okay. We talked a bit about, I'm more curious about these aspects of general relativity. You said we can actually test several aspects of general relativity and therefore really show that it still holds where we are looking at it. But what exactly are these effects?
Well, okay, so when you look at the theory, then you can actually, so to speak, split the predictions by the theoretical side up into different orders of, on the one hand, ever smaller effect, but also ever more subtle, okay? So we have not proven all of the effects of general relativity at this point. For instance, we have not yet been able to measure the spin of the black hole in the galactic center. We've measured another property of general relativity, which is very important, and that's the so-called Schwarzschild precession. So, the two biggest effects in general relativity you would expect. One is the fact that when there's a star near the black hole and the star sends photons to us, then these photons have to climb out of the gravitational potential. And so that means that, they get redshifted.
Yeah.
Another way of saying this, the clocks are going slower there than here.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the first effect we saw right away in 2018. In fact, halfway through this Perry approach of the star, and we already had the effect. It's the biggest effect you can see. Then 2 years later, we had the so-called Schwarzschild precession. What is that? Well, if you have in Newtonian terms, if you have a central mass, and then you have a second object which orbits around this in a stable orbit, in a plane. If there's nothing else around, you have only these two objects, and this one dominates, then this is a very simple two-body or central force problem where the orbital shape here stays always the same in Newton. Always the same, so it doesn't change.
Yeah.
Not in general relativity. In general relativity, it changes by precessing in the plane of this orbit in forward direction. And the change is the bigger, the closer in. Okay. And so that effect we've seen, and the clarity with which we can see it, first of all, it is a confirmation of general relativity, but also it tells you that there can't be anything else. This is what I said before. This thing is lonely.
Yeah.
This black hole. Suppose there's not just a single black hole, but two. Well, then that gives a very different pattern of this orbital change. So that we can see, and from that we can make estimates about the environment of the black hole. For instance, many people have predicted that so-called dark matter might get sort of attracted by the black hole and sort of form a sort of a halo around it. And we could set now pretty strong limits how much additional matter around the big black hole, say in form of dark matter, can be there. So that's astrophysically of importance.
Yeah. Yeah.
In that sense, this is not about general relativity, but as a question about the, so to speak, the object itself, and how did it form and how does it interact with the environment. The spin, if the black hole spin, there is obviously a direction. So if you now have a star which goes in a plane like this, it also starts to wobble around about the spin direction. That's called a lens-Thirring precession. That lens-Thirring precession for the star we've seen is about 50 times smaller than the position we've seen. Mm-hmm. So that one we have not yet been able to see.
Will you be able to see it?
We hope if there is a star which goes closer. So all these effects go like the smallest radius where the star goes relative to the event horizon, R over R Schwarzschild, to some power.
Okay.
So the higher order terms and say the lens steering position, there the power is 3/2.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the closer in it goes, the stronger the effect is. So we are hoping by improving the sensitivity of our interferometric machine by another factor of 100 currently, then we might see stars which go deeper into the, still deeper. Will they be there? We can't tell.
Yeah.
It's just a question of hoping again that nature is good to us. Yeah. Maybe not.
What if that's not the case? Are there other ways to measure the spin?
Yeah, there are. I mean, I've talked about the innermost region where we see this gas.
Yeah,
we might gather some information on the spin there, and likewise the radio astronomy measurement also mm-hmm. in principle depends also on the spin. It's not very strong, so I'm not very hopeful.
Yeah.
Finally, gravitational waves. I mean, that I would say is a very likely contender, not in the galactic center necessarily, but in a nearby galaxy or even a distant galaxy. So if you have a big black hole, and then you have a stellar black hole,
mm-hmm.
then the same happens as what LIGO had seen with two stellar black holes. The stellar black hole, if it comes close enough, starts losing energy by radiating gravitational waves and then starts inspiraling. And so then you can actually gather extremely important information about the innermost region around the event horizon, so to speak, in the last loop before the stellar black hole mm-hmm. falls in. That is something which, in principle, the LIGO experiment wanted and has done from the in-spiral of two stellar black holes.
Yeah.
But the problem is that it happens so fast. In the case of stellar black holes, this last orbit, so to speak, takes only 0.1 seconds mm-hmm. or 100 milliseconds.
Yeah.
Not enough time to really measure the properties.
Yeah.
Very well. But if you have a big black hole, one of our million or billion solar mass black holes and a stellar black hole, then these last turns take weeks.
Okay.
And so you have a long time to measure, with high accuracy.
Yeah.
So that is an experiment which, however, has to be done in space. You can't do that on the mm-hmm. ground. So the European Space Agency and probably NASA together, we will see, planning an experiment, a very, very ambitious experiment of having three satellites 2 million kilometers away from each other, sending laser beams to each other. And this machine called LISA might then see one of these inspirals called extreme mass ratio inspirals of a stellar black hole into a big black hole.
Okay.
And that, in a way, is the ultimate experiment, I would say.
Yeah. So talking about other galaxies, so the event horizon has, a telescope has imaged the black hole at the center of our galaxy and the one at M87. Now, could you do observations that you did at the galactic center, similar ones also, for example, at M87?
Yeah, we could if we could. The answer is we can't because of the location of the telescopes in Chile.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, I mean, you're absolutely right. That would be a dream experiment. The nearest galaxy is the Andromeda galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
Nearest big galaxy
yeah.
is the big Andromeda is Andromeda galaxy, and that one has a black hole which is, let's see, 20 times more massive than the galactic center,
mm-hmm.
and that one would be ideal to look at the motions of the stars there.
Mm-hmm.
It has been used in a spectroscopic sense, so the spectroscopic experiment has led to the determination of the central mass, but we would have the resolution to then see individual stars, and then you could, so to speak, do parts of the galactic center experiment there. But Andromeda is in the northern hemisphere, and mm-hmm. so we cannot do that with with the VLT. And so,
but
indeed, I think we are using dynamical motions to measure the masses of black holes. In fact, 10 billion years ago. How do we do that? Well, we use the fact that active black holes, we call active galactic nuclei, of which these quasars are sort of, to speak, the tip of the iceberg, get ever more common when you go back in time. And that is because in the early parts of the universe, when the galaxies were growing very rapidly, black holes were growing rapidly. So there were many more episodes of strong accretion. And so then you have, in almost every active galactic nucleus, an innermost ionized region, which empirically we know must be moving at a velocity which is equal to the, you know, the orbital velocity. And so if you can resolve that, then you can measure the masses of the black holes. You cannot test general relativity, but you can measure black. And we've done that now with quasars at a redshift of 2.5, so that's about 11 giga years ago, so only about 2.5 giga years after the Big Bang. And so, yes, we can use the same techniques to make measurements of masses and hopefully with increasing precision measure the growth of these black holes with these techniques.
And the telescopes Andrea Goetz is using, they are in the Northern Hemisphere, right?
Yeah, they are more or less in the Northern Hemisphere, and more or less because it's plus 15, plus 17 degrees in latitude. But they could look at Andromeda for sure. But they don't have interferometry. So that's they do have two telescopes. So there are two 10-meter telescopes in the Keck. And in fact, in the distant past, there was a plan to add more telescopes so one could perhaps do interferometry, but then it wasn't realized at the time.
Well, it would be nice if they were also able to do interferometry. Then you could cover the.
No, absolutely, and I have to say, I think if you're a radio astronomer and you want to build a bit bigger telescope, no radio astronomer would build a bigger single-dish telescope.
Yeah.
It's very clear, big and high resolution come together, and therefore you just build a bigger interferometer. That's very clear. But for the reasons we discussed, that cannot or could not be done in the optical or near-infrared up to now, but now we can.
Yeah.
So I would, I'm not a prophet, but I would say could very well be that the success of the VLT-I, the interferometer of the VLT, will lead in the future to new projects, which then don't build a single big telescope, but instead, do interferometry.
Yeah, that sounds sensible in a sense,
Yeah, we have covered a lot and we've seen that this is really a fascinating environment.
I mean, I think it shows you the fascination of the universe and how much with modern techniques we can do in astronomy. I mean, it's not just in the black hole issue, there's also the exoplanet story, the cosmology story. In that sense, astronomy, as old as science it is, it is now one of the most fascinating parts of physics. And the remarkable thing, you see this in Nobel Prizes. I mean, it used to be the case that there were no Nobel Prizes in astronomy, perhaps also because the physics community would not accept. And there's also the will of Nobel and so forth, but that's not the case anymore. I mean, now it's really one of the more active areas of research.
Yeah, and it's really just that in the 20th century we started opening all the other wavelengths apart from the optical astronomy, right? Because optical astronomy, yes, people have been doing for hundreds of years, thousands of years, looking at the stars with their eyes with telescopes, but only, yeah, since less than 100 years we
But look,
actually see
let's
other.
be realistic, okay? And we of course we can ask ourselves a sort of an interesting but a little more challenging question: what will happen in the future? Yeah? Will that go on? Will we build eventually ever bigger telescopes? Well, in Chile, ESO is now building a 40-meter telescope. Yeah, the ELT. In fact, our institute will. Or is supposed to build the first instrument for it. This is already 2 billion euros, and the instrument we are building is, in the end, if you're all told, about 60 million euros. That is already becoming difficult, if not in the future impossible, for science institutes. Even Max Planck Institutes. Okay, we are in a European collaboration, so we're sharing this around. But it's very clear if you look to the U.S., for instance, the normal university system already has stopped in experimental astrophysics quite a while ago. There are NASA institutions. They are, very richly endowed private universities, which have been able, Harvard, Caltech, and so forth. But even those are beginning to have difficulties forming. It's a combination of the cost and the time over which, this takes time, as we discussed. And donors may give you, I mean, the Mr. Keck was willing to give 200 million euros, the dollars for the Keck telescopes. So that's tremendous, but it's harder to get a donor who gives you 10 million euros a year for 10 years, because it's not as spectacular, right? I mean, Keck telescopes, you can say, oh, look up there, and so on. But the donors are not willing to give that for salaries and so forth. So that's so as we look in the future, we may have to worry at what level. Funding institutions will say, oh, it's beautiful stuff you're doing, but look,
Yeah. True.
Now, of course, there is the issue of what is it good for, right? And the advantage we have, say, with black holes, is it's really exciting to young people. Believe me, I mean, I give so many talks, and it's far more exciting for young people to hear that story than some of the more, shall we say, relevant issues you might imagine, because it's a combination of science fiction, but then there's the weirdness of it all, and yet it's real science. And so in a way we have the privilege, and that helps us to get young people excited about science.
Yeah, that's really the thing that just space, the universe, astrophysics, astronomy is really to great part of the general public. It's just a fascinating topic. Yeah, that's nice. Okay, I think we've had a pretty great conversation.
Very
Thank you
nice.
so much for joining this podcast.
Okay, well, I'm delighted that this was interesting to you.
Yes, definitely.
That's it. Thank you so much for listening. This was the final episode of my black hole series. If you liked it and if you liked this podcast, please hit subscribe. I would love to hear your feedback on the series, so don't hesitate to contact us via Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn or email. Offspring Magazine, the podcast, is brought to you by the Max Planck PhDNet and the Science Communication Working Group known as the Offspring Magazine. The intro-outro music is composed by Srinath Rankumar, and the pre-intro jingle is composed by Gustavo Garizzo. For any feedback, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to write us at offspring.podcast@phdnet.mpg.de. Until next week, stay safe, stay healthy. Bye-bye.